This is Lecture 3 in the series Inflation and Price Controls.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Before I begin the subject of tonight's lecture, I will summarize for you the relevant results of the first two lectures. In Lecture 1, our objective was to find out why the general consumer price level increases. Our first step was to realize that the general consumer price level equals, indeed is, the spending for consumers' goods divided by the quantity of them sold. That is, the demand divided by the supply. It followed from this that the consumer price level could rise in only two ways. Either there had to be more spending for consumers' goods, or a smaller quantity of them sold. We then saw why the explanation had to be more spending, not a smaller quantity of consumers' goods sold. Finally, we traced more spending to the government's expansion of the money supply. Last week, in Lecture 2, we refuted the attempts to explain rising prices other than on the basis of more spending. That is, we refuted the cost push doctrine in all of its variants, namely the so-called wage push, profit push, and crisis push doctrines. We saw that all of these doctrines were the same as an attempt to blame inflation on less supply, and were therefore totally invalid. We saw that in reality, the continued existence of so-called cost push inflation is only possible on the basis of an expanding aggregate demand, namely more spending. Tonight, as promised, I am going to refute a second group of theories that are opposed to the quantity theory of money, theories which seek to keep the blame for inflation away from the government. This group concedes the fact that more demand is indispensable to inflation, but it denies that an expanding quantity of money is the cause of the growth in demand. It tries to blame something else for the growth in demand, such as an increase in the, quote, velocity of circulation of money, an expression I will explain shortly, or the existence of inflation psychology, the use of credit cards, the granting of consumer installment credit, or the, quote, greed of consumers. The most important doctrine in this group is the first one, the one that tries to blame inflation on an increase in the velocity of circulation of money. That is, on an increase in the speed with which a given quantity of money is spent. I call this doctrine simply the velocity doctrine. It is the most important because it embraces all of the others, and because it is widely taught to college students in a deliberate attempt to undercut the quantity theory of money. I will first present the velocity doctrine and then refute it. Let us begin by understanding just what is meant by the expression the velocity of circulation of money, or simply velocity for short. It is the number of times that the average dollar of the money supply is spent during the year. I will repeat this definition. The velocity of money is the number of times that the average dollar of the money supply is spent during the year. Arithmetically, velocity is always equal to the amount of spending during the year divided by the quantity of money. Just take the quantity of money, divide it into the amount of spending, and the result is velocity. Or, as I express it in the handout you have before you, velocity of circulation, this is on page 2 of the handout, velocity of circulation equals aggregate demand divided by the money supply. V equals D over M. If you now look at item 2 in the handout, the table, you can see some concrete applications of this formula. What I have done in that table is to take the money supply figures that were distributed to you in lecture 1 and divide them into the gross national product, or GNP, for the same years. GNP is an approximation to consumer spending. If you look at the table and care to work it out, you will see that each figure in column 3, the column that shows velocity, is the result of dividing the money supply from column 1 into the consumer demand, or GNP, of column 2. For example, the 26.2 billion money supply of 1929 goes into the 103.1 billion GNP of 1929 about 3.9 times. That's the velocity of money for 1929. That means the average dollar of the money supply in 1929 was spent 3.9 times in buying consumers' goods. In 1975, 295 billion of money went into the roughly 1,500 billion of GNP about 5.1 times. That's the velocity of money for 1975. So in that year, the average dollar was spent 5.1 times in buying consumers' goods. Now we are in a position to understand what the velocity doctrine is. The velocity doctrine is the claim that the increase in aggregate demand is not the result of a larger quantity of money, but of a more rapid spending of a given quantity of money, that is, of a higher velocity of money. More demand, says the velocity doctrine, is caused not by more money, but by the same money being spent a larger number of times during the year. The velocity doctrine can be expressed in terms of the equation that appears as item 3 in the handout that was distributed to you. That equation reads, money supply times velocity of circulation equals aggregate demand, or MV equals D for short. This equation is obviously derived from the equation in item 1. It is the equation in item 1, but with both sides multiplied by m. Now I want to say that I do not object to this equation, mv equals d. It is a perfectly correct equation. The money supply times the number of times the average dollar of the money supply is spent during the year definitely does equal the total spending for the year. What I object to is the use the velocity doctrine makes of this equation. The supporters of the velocity doctrine look at this equation, and they look at the statistical variation of velocity over the years, and they believe that they are then justified in regarding velocity as an independent causal force determining demand or spending. They go further. They observe large changes in velocity. For example, they may observe, on the basis of the figures in our table, that since 1945, the velocity of money has increased almost as much as the quantity of money, 2.4 times as against 2.9 times. On the basis of such observations, they conclude that changes in velocity are at least as important as changes in the quantity of money. And then, with no further evidence of any kind, they leap to the conclusion that changes in velocity are far more important than changes in the quantity of money, and that changes in the quantity of money are unimportant. The supporters of the velocity doctrine argue that such statistics suggest the possibility that even if the money supply had not increased, the same increase in spending as occurred between 1945 and 1975 could have been achieved by a still greater increase in velocity. Indeed, say these economists, the possibility must be left open that not only major, but limitless increases in demand can occur strictly on the basis of velocity increases, and therefore that increases in the quantity of money are of no significance at all. For example, they would argue that our present money supply of about $300 billion could support not only the present consumer spending of about $1,500 billion, but a consumer spending of 2, 3, 10, or 100 times more, just by being spent faster. Allegedly, no increase in the quantity of money would be required. Of course, say these economists, the unimportance of increases in the quantity of money is not a proven fact. It is merely a logical possibility, based on their ability to imagine increases in spending corresponding entirely to increases in velocity. However, conclude these economists, until the evidence is in, disproving this alleged logical possibility, we cannot be at all certain of the importance of increases in the quantity of money. And because we allegedly cannot be certain, we must not point the finger of guilt at the government. The government must be allowed to go on expanding the quantity of money as rapidly as it likes. This is the velocity argument. It is fallacious from beginning to end. First of all, the causal role of increases in the quantity of money, of the fact that an additional quantity of money will be spent and re-spent so long as it continues in existence, has already been established, just as we established it back in Lecture 1 in examples of gold miners obtaining new coins or Social Security recipients obtaining additional quantities of fiat money. And the role of increases in the quantity of money is confirmed by all of the statistics, including those which the supporters of the velocity doctrine cite. For example, our table does show an almost threefold increase in the quantity of money between 1945 and 1975. This is hardly a basis for denying the importance of the increase in the quantity of money in expanding demand. Nevertheless, the supporters of the velocity doctrine simply choose to ignore all knowledge of the effects of an increase in the quantity of money and to claim that because something else, besides the increase in the money supply, appears to have a major independent effect on demand, the money supply has no effect. But there is much more to say against the velocity argument. As I will prove shortly, the truth is that the most important cause of changes in the velocity of money are changes in the quantity of money. I will show that changes in the velocity of money are not an independent causal determinant of spending at all. For the most part, they are simply the reflection of the further, the indirect influence of changes in the quantity of money. Let us begin our critique by understanding more fully the nature of the velocity of money. It is not an entity, and it has no independent existence. It is a mere mathematical expression found by dividing demand by the quantity of money, as we have seen. If you recall, that is how each value of velocity was derived in the table you have, which is why I show velocity in the last column to indicate that it is derived from the other two. As such, velocity is not the cause of anything. It is always the reflection of other factors which are the real causes. Now I will show that what velocity reflects is the desire of people to hold money in reserve as an asset. By this expression, I refer to the fact that individuals and business enterprises need to hold money in order to make purchases and pay bills in the future. They cannot spend their full money holdings all at once in the present because they need to hold money in reserve in order to meet these future obligations. In order to understand what determines velocity, we need to know what determines the desire of people to hold money. Because the greater is the desire to hold money, the smaller will be velocity. The smaller is the desire to hold money, the greater will be velocity. The reason for this relationship between velocity and the desire to hold money can be understood by considering the case of any given individual who owns money. Suppose we have an individual who owns $1,000 in the form of currency or a checking deposit. If this individual feels that he needs to hold, say, $700 out of this thousand in order to make purchases or pay bills in the period starting 1 week from the present, then the most he can afford to spend out of his $1,000 this week is $300. If, however, he should decide that he only needs to hold, say, $600 for the period starting a week later, then this week he could afford to spend $400 out of the thousand he owns. Clearly, the individual's ability to spend the money he owns is greater the less of it he needs to hold for the future, and is less the more of it he needs to hold for the future. It follows that anything that occurs which makes individuals decide to reduce the cash they hold for the future will increase spending and therefore velocity. By the same token, anything that occurs that makes individuals decide that they need to increase the cash they hold for the future will reduce spending and therefore velocity. We are now in a position to see how changes in the quantity of money are the principal factor responsible for changes in the velocity of money. Because, as we will see, changes in the quantity of money are the major factor causing changes in the desire to hold money. Specifically, the more rapidly money increases, the less is the desire of people to own it. Conversely, the more slowly money increases, the greater is the desire of people to own it. I'll repeat this relation. The more rapidly money increases, the less is the desire of people to own it. Conversely, the more slowly money increases, the greater is the desire of people to own it. We can find some immediate confirmation of this principle if we ask which currencies people prefer to own and why. For example, Argentine pesos, English pounds, or US dollars. Obviously, the peso is the least desirable of the three currencies to own, and the dollar the most desirable. The reason the peso is the least desirable of the three is that it is the one whose quantity is the most rapidly expanded, and which therefore loses purchasing power the fastest. As a result, no one wants to own more than the barest minimum of pesos necessary to transact business in Argentina. The dollar, on the other hand, is the most desirable of the three to own because its quantity is expanded the least rapidly, and it therefore retains its purchasing power better than the others. We can find some further confirmation of this principle if we observe what has happened to the desirability of owning dollars in the last few years, as the rate at which they are increased has accelerated, and as its loss in purchasing power has become more rapid. Obviously, the desirability of owning dollars has diminished. Many people who previously owned dollar checking balances or accumulations of dollars in safety deposit boxes have switched to holding Swiss francs or to gold or silver instead. This is a factor that increases the velocity of dollars, because these dollars that were previously held as long-term cash reserves have now been thrown into active circulation. This discussion of the comparative desirability of owning different currencies suggests two connections between changes in the quantity of money and the velocity of money. The first of these connections pertains to prices, and that is that the anticipation of a rise in prices in the future, resulting from an expanding quantity of money, reduces the desire of people to hold money, because in such circumstances, it pays to buy goods right away before their prices rise. Conversely, the anticipation of a fall in prices in the future, resulting from a contraction in the quantity of money, increases the desirability of owning money. In such circumstances, it pays people to postpone purchases in order to take advantage of lower prices in the future. The second connection between changes in the quantity of money and the velocity of money concerns the ability to substitute holdings of other assets for holdings of money. If the quantity of money is increasing rapidly, it pays to hold other assets, such as inventories of various commodities, rather than money itself. In such circumstances, these other assets are a better source of meeting future needs for cash than the holding of money itself, because they can easily be sold for more money than they cost. This principle applies not only to businessmen holding inventories of commodities that they process or produce, but also to consumers. As inflation accelerates, it pays even the ordinary consumer to hold commodities as a source of future cash rather than cash itself. Above all, gold and silver, or less rapidly inflating foreign monies, as we saw a few moments ago. Conversely, if the quantity of money were decreasing rather than increasing, not only would the holding of commodities be a bad idea, because their prices would be falling, but people would want to hold money even in place of such things as short-term securities and savings and time deposits. That is because in such circumstances, namely a deflation and depression, people cannot be sure of converting these money substitutes into actual money, since the issuer of the securities or the bank where one has the deposit may go broke first. This is a reason why every period of deflation is a period of an intensified desire to hold money, and therefore of a drop in the velocity of money. Now, there are two further reasons why increases in the quantity of money tend to increase velocity, and why decreases in the quantity of money tend to decrease it. These reasons pertain to the effects of changes in the quantity of money on the availability of credit and on interest rates. Please observe that the desire to hold money, especially on the part of business firms, is largely determined by the prospective availability of credit. If credit is expected to be easily available when funds are required, the desire to hold money will be correspondingly less. If credit is expected to be unavailable or available only with great difficulty when funds are required, the desire to hold money will be correspondingly greater. Now, the increase or decrease in the money supply is a major factor determining the availability of credit at any given time. When the money supply is increasing, a very large portion of the increase usually enters the economic system in the form of new loans, with the result that credit is made easier. This is what people have in mind when they talk of, quote, easy money. Conversely, when the money supply decreases, as in a depression accompanied by bank failures, the decrease results in a sharp reduction in the availability of credit. Consequently, an expansion of the money supply reduces the need to hold money through its effect on the availability of credit. In an economy which has become accustomed to easy money, or which offers the prospect of easy money, businessmen will consider it safe to operate with lower money balances than they would otherwise. They will expect to be able to obtain more of the money they will later require through credit at the time. Consequently, they will invest more fully, either in the purchase of physical assets or in the purchase of securities. And since those who receive this money will tend to behave in the same way, what occurs is an increase in the total volume of spending, lending, and trading of all kinds in relation to the quantity of money. That is, there is an increase in the velocity of money. On the other hand, in a deflationary period, when the quantity of money is falling and credit is virtually unobtainable, businessmen will find it necessary to hold relatively large money balances with a corresponding reduction in the velocity of money. Now let us turn to the connection between money and velocity that operates through the rate of interest. In our critique of the profit push doctrine last week, we saw that an expanding quantity of money raises the nominal rate of profit, if you think back to that discussion. This rise in the nominal rate of profit brings about a rise in the nominal rate of interest. The rate of interest rises because the higher rate of profit permits business borrowers to offer a higher rate of interest, and their mutual competition for loans forces them to do so. Now, the rise in the nominal rate of interest is significant in drawing out of cash holdings sums that it would not pay to invest at lower rates of interest. It does this by decreasing both the size of the principal and the period of time for which it must be invested in order to make lending worthwhile. For example, at a 2% rate of interest, it would probably not pay to lend $50,000 for a period as short as a week, because the interest that could be earned would only amount to about $20. It might pay to lend $1 million for a week, but not $50,000 at such a low rate of interest. This means that firms with sums of $50,000 or less that they do not need for a week would probably decide simply to hold those funds in cash rather than lend or invest them for the week. And they would probably decide to do the same even with sums a good deal larger than $50,000. But at an 8 or 10% rate of interest, it might pay to lend out funds as small as $50,000 for a week. A rise in the rate of interest, as I say, reduces the size of the principal that must be involved to make lending worthwhile. And in a similar way, it reduces the period of time for which the funds must be available to make lending worthwhile. For example, at a 2% rate of interest, it might not be profitable to lend $50,000 for any period less than a month or more. But at an 8 or 10% rate of interest, as we have just seen, it might pay to lend such a sum even for a week. It follows from this discussion that as the rate of interest rises, it becomes profitable to lend out progressively smaller and shorter term sums. Consequently, these sums are drawn out of money holdings and into the stream of spending. In this way, a rise in interest rates, itself caused by an increase in the quantity of money, which raises profits, which raise interest, this rise in interest raises the velocity of money. In the four ways I have explained then, increases in the quantity of money raise the velocity of money, and decreases in the quantity of money decrease it. Let us now turn to the statistics of velocity, which you have on page 2 of the handout. Our knowledge of how changes in the quantity of money cause changes in the velocity of money enables us to understand why velocity has been rising in the United States since the end of World War II, as shown in the table. In one sentence, the reason is the virtually uninterrupted increase in the money supply since 1933. Our table shows, of course, that the velocity of circulation fell from 1933 to 1945, despite very major increases in the money supply. But that is not difficult to explain. The disastrous deflation of the early 30s, in which the money supply fell by more than 25%, in which credit was unobtainable by virtually all but the strongest enterprises, in which thousands upon thousands of firms went bankrupt, these were experiences that guaranteed a very high degree of financial conservatism for many years to come. As a result, even though the money supply began to increase again after 1933, funds were used to an uncommon degree to build liquidity. That is, firms chose to operate with unusually large money balances. They acted out of fear of a possible recurrence of deflation. This explains the continuing fall in velocity during the remainder of the 30s. In World War II, velocity fell because of wartime government controls that limited demand. During the war, the government imposed all-round price and wage controls and instituted a system of consumer rationing. This necessarily limited the amount of spending because no one could spend a sum larger than the controlled prices times the limited quantities of goods he was allotted. At the same time, of course, the money supply was sharply increased. The combination of a governmentally limited demand and a sharply rising money supply mathematically necessitated a falling velocity of circulation. By the early post-war years, the memory of the Great Depression and the fear of its recurrence had largely worn off, and from this period on, the velocity of circulation began to rise. As the inflation continued and gave no sign of interruption, people came to behave accordingly. And thus, by 1965, we see velocity reaching levels in excess of the 1929 peak. The post-war increase in the velocity of circulation is exactly what we would expect on the basis of our theoretical knowledge. Consequently, it is completely mistaken to point to it as any kind of refutation of the quantity theory of money. It is itself an effect of the increase in the quantity of money and provides a further confirmation of the quantity theory of money. Now, the question may be raised of whether other factors besides the increase in the quantity of money can reduce the desire to hold money and thereby raise the velocity of circulation. The answer to this question is yes, but these factors are irrelevant to the problem of inflation. Such factors as the development of more rapid methods of payment, made possible by the existence of clearing houses, increases in the speed of transporting money, and the like, can reduce the need to hold money and thereby raise the velocity of money. But the development of these factors is slow and gradual, and is accompanied by an offsetting process that largely or entirely cancels its effect on consumer demand. The offsetting process is a tendency toward need for a greater number of payments in the production and distribution of ultimate consumers' goods. For example, instead of a farmer selling his food to a consumer, he sells it to a food processor, who sells it to a wholesaler, who in turn sells to a retailer. Possibly several processors or wholesalers are involved. Such developments are continuing in our day, namely the intensification of the stages involved. Consequently, while the total spending of all types combined rises as a result of increases in the speed with which payments can be made, it does not follow that spending specifically for consumers' goods rises. In other words, the velocity that rises is what economists call the, quote, transactions velocity of money, the ratio of total spending of all kinds to the quantity of money, but not necessarily income velocity, the ratio of the specific spending for consumers' goods to the quantity of money, which is the kind of velocity we have been concerned with. So the point here is, increases in the speed of payments can expand the total volume of spending in the economy, but much of this spending is not for consumer goods, but for different stages in the process of producing consumer goods, wholesale transactions, manufacturers' transactions, and so on. Both increases in the speed of payment and in the complexity of the process of production and distribution have been going on since the beginning of our history, and there is no reason to believe that the one would suddenly and consistently have outstripped the other since 1945. In addition, increases in the speed of payments are an offshoot of increases in production. The same factors that make it possible to transport money or process payments more rapidly also make it possible to transport and process goods more rapidly. As a result, one might well expect mere increases in the speed of payments to be accompanied by falling prices, not rising prices. What is true is that the rapid increase in the quantity of money, the high nominal interest rates it causes, and the general incentives it gives to operating with a minimum of money balances have placed a special premium on stepping up the speed of payments in recent years. Today, for example, there are corporations that ask their customers to mail their payments to one location rather than another in order to save a day's time in the mail so that the money may be deposited more quickly and earn additional interest. But this sort of thing is the result of the expansion in the quantity of money, not any kind of normal improvement in the technology of making payments. It brings us back again to the fact that increases in the quantity of money are the cause of increases in the velocity of circulation. In other words, it brings us back to the quantity theory. There remain a number of variations on the velocity argument to consider. The best known of these is probably the, quote, inflation psychology argument. As used by its supporters, the term inflation psychology is supposed to refer to an uncaused primary. That is, people allegedly have an inflation psychology, and that is supposed to be the ultimate cause of inflation. Why they have an inflation psychology is a question that is not raised, let alone considered. Now, of course, there is such a thing as inflation psychology, but it is not a primary. It is based on the fact of inflation. It has come into existence only after many years of uninterrupted inflation. Properly understood, what the term really refers to is the various ways in which a rapidly expanding quantity of money reduces the desire of people to hold money. Properly used, the term embraces the four connections we traced between an expanding quantity of money and a rising velocity of money. Inflation psychology actually refers to more than these connections between an expanding quantity of money and a rising velocity of money that I outlined. It refers to more because these connections have an effect on prices by way of raising demand. Inflation psychology also has an influence on prices from the side of supply. That is, it influences the expectations of sellers. For example, if businessmen come to anticipate that in the years ahead, inflation will raise the replacement costs of their plant and equipment, they may begin to raise prices today in order to be in a position to accumulate sufficient replacement funds. Similarly, workers may demand wage increases in advance in order to cover the rise in prices they expect to occur over the life of their employment contracts. And lenders may demand interest rates high enough to cover the increase in prices they expect to occur over the life of their loan contracts. These forces can be considered as a kind of cost push induced by inflation itself. All of them represent a rise in prices beyond the levels appropriate to the current size of demand. They have, of course, the exact same limitations as cost push and would disappear if inflation were to stop. Now, sometimes when the government makes an effort to cut back on inflation and really does reduce the rate at which it expands the money supply for a while, some observers who are familiar with the quantity theory of money are surprised to see that prices continue to rise at a substantial rate. And they take this fact as evidence against the quantity theory, claiming that it shows that inflation psychology exists and is leading a life of its own, so to speak. The error in this reasoning is not hard to find. So long as our money is a paper money that the government can inflate as much as it likes, there is no reason for people to believe that the government will not soon resume a more rapid rate of inflation, especially in view of the fact that the whole philosophy of the mixed economy drives it to do so. In order to convince people that it is serious in its determination to end inflation, the government must restrict its increase in the quantity of money for a protracted period. In the meanwhile, however, because people have had no reason to believe that the government would continue to limit itself, they will probably have placed themselves in badly overextended positions in which they are operating with too low money balances, have overborrowed, and are asking excessive wages and prices, all in the expectation that inflation will bail them out. In this context, stopping the inflation or significantly restricting it must precipitate a crisis. And then the government must either allow the crisis to occur or, to avoid it, give in and fulfill people's expectation that inflation will resume. It would be a serious mistake to describe this situation by saying that the government is forced to resume inflating in response to the inflation psychology of the people. It is the government's ability to inflate and its repeated use of that ability in the past that has created the inflation psychology and that makes the consequences of finally stopping the inflation so severe. This type of situation, I want to point out, illustrates an inherent flaw of paper money. The fact that paper money can be inflated and over time is inflated causes expectations about future inflation. The existence of these expectations then makes it impossible to stop inflating without a crisis, while the threat of the crisis induces the government to resume and accelerate the inflation. Inflation psychology is an inevitable consequence of paper money and is a critical step in its ultimate downfall. Please observe that inflation psychology could not exist on a gold standard, because on such a standard it could have no factual basis. If somehow such a psychology began to develop, it would quickly run up against the fact that the money supply did not keep up with it, because it simply could not. The consequence would be that any incipient inflation psychology would disappear. Now let us turn to the attempt to blame inflation on the use of credit cards. The supporters of the credit card argument view credit cards as making possible a rise in spending without any expansion of the quantity of money. They observe, for example, that people who carry credit cards do not need to carry as much cash as previously, and they conclude on this basis that credit cards contribute to a rise in the velocity of money by making possible more spending in relation to the same quantity of money. Now, the first objection to be made to the credit card doctrine is that most of the reduction it makes possible in the need to hold money is merely apparent and not real. To prove this point, let us consider the case of cards like the American Express card, in which all charges are billed within a few weeks. The holder of such a card need not carry currency in his pocket. That is certainly true. But he must have money to pay his credit card bill when it comes due. As a result, the money that such an individual is spared from holding in currency, he must hold in his checking account in order to be able to pay his bill when it comes due. The only way that one could imagine this type of credit card increasing the velocity of circulation would be to imagine that an individual was in a position to make a temporary investment of the currency he saves. For example, suppose someone spends $100 on his American Express card and knows that he has a month before he will be billed. If he were in a position to take the $100 in currency he saves and invest it, and then get out of the investment right before his credit card bill comes due, then, in fact, the velocity of circulation would rise. But very few credit card holders are in this position. Perhaps some large corporations whose executives have company cards are in a position to capitalize on this type of situation. But even in their case, the fact that they would bother to do so is most likely a result of the high nominal interest rates caused by the expanding quantity of money, which we discussed earlier. Observe further. In the case of credit cards where all the charges come due within a short period, it is probably the case that the overall need to hold money is increased rather than decreased. This is because not only must the owner of the credit card hold money to pay his bill, but in addition, the credit card company needs to hold money to pay the businessmen from whom the cardholders buy. Observe, there are now two transactions and the need for two cash holdings, whereas before there was only one transaction and the need for only one cash holding. What I mean is this. Before credit cards, an individual who went to a restaurant, say, had to carry currency to pay his restaurant bill. Now he has to hold that same money in his checking account to pay his credit card bill when it comes due. In addition, however, the credit card company has to hold money to pay the restaurant, which it must do before it collects from the cardholder. So two cash holdings are required in place of one. Now, what about the kind of credit cards that can be paid off gradually over many months, like Bank AmeriCard or the MasterCharge card? In practice, many owners use these cards in just the same way as the American Express card. But these cards have a wider potential because they represent the granting of a line of bank credit to their holders. By that I mean that whoever owns such a card has the right to borrow up to some agreed upon sum from the bank involved anytime he wishes. That is what is meant by a line of bank credit. These credit cards, therefore, can in fact reduce the amount of money that people need to hold to some degree. They do so in cases in which a person was previously holding money on the chance that he might come across something he wanted to buy and was uncertain that he would be able to obtain a loan to buy it. Such a person need not hold that money now. His loan is guaranteed in advance by virtue of his ownership of the credit card and the line of credit it conveys. But now we must ask the question of how it happened that the banks could extend lines of credit to people who previously would have been uncertain of being able to obtain loans for specific purposes. The answer brings us back once again to the quantity theory of money. The banks can extend additional lines of credit because they are in the position to expand the money supply by creating checking deposits that they can lend out. Thus, what we are dealing with in this case is nothing but the influence of an expanding money supply on the availability of credit, which we discussed earlier tonight. The ability of banks to expand the money supply enables them to create lines of credit not only for business enterprises, which can thereby reduce their holdings of money, but also for consumers, with the same result. To the extent that credit cards do in fact raise velocity, therefore, the rise must be considered a symptom of the expanding quantity of money. Now, the objection might be made to what I have just said, that even without the bank's ability to create money, credit cards would still have come into existence and might still have reduced the need to hold money on the part of the owners of the cards. That is probably true to some extent. But in the absence of the bank's ability to inflate, the extension of additional lines of credit would be strictly limited, and the only way that the banks could extend additional lines of credit at all, whether to consumers holding credit cards or to any other type of borrower, would be as a result of additional savings on the part of their depositors. But please observe, if the base of the additional lines of credit is additional savings by the depositors, then what is presupposed at the very beginning is a corresponding reduction in consumer demand, because the depositors can save more only in degree that they consume less. Credit and lines of credit based on savings, therefore, do not raise the overall spending for consumers' goods, because the origin of such credit and such lines of credit is a reduction in the spending for consumers' goods on the part of the depositors. What happens in this case is not an increase in spending, but a transfer of spending power from the bank's depositors to the bank's borrowers. To put this as succinctly as possible, saved credit is not inflationary. The granting of saved credit is not inflationary. Only credit based on the ability to expand the money supply is inflationary. This last observation applies to a further attempt to explain inflation, namely to the doctrine that inflation is the result of the granting of consumer installment credit. According to this doctrine, prices are rising Because the granting of consumer installment credit enables consumers to make an additional demand for goods. Now, this doctrine is true to the extent that the credit is granted on the basis of newly created money. But it is false to the extent that the credit is granted out of saved funds. Because to the extent that consumers obtain credit out of saved funds, the savers have first had to restrict their consumption before the consumer borrowers can expand theirs. There is no increase in overall consumer spending here, but just a transfer of spending power from one set of buyers to another. Consequently, once again, we have a case in which an opposing doctrine turns out to confirm the quantity theory of money, because the only way the installment credit doctrine could be true is on the basis of an expanding quantity of money. The last opposing doctrine on inflation to be considered is the claim that inflation is the result of the consumer's, quote, greed. Sometimes it is the consumer's mere desire for a better life that is named as the cause of inflation, and in those very words. Insofar as this doctrine differs from the installment credit doctrine, its supporters appear to have in mind a case in which the consumers simply go out and overbid one another in their desire for more goods. It is possible that the supporters of the doctrine have in mind the scene of an auction in which the bidders scramble for a limited number of items and drive prices to high levels in their enthusiasm. Now, such action on the part of the consumers could explain how the price of a few items might rise, but it cannot explain how the general price level rises. It cannot, because it does not tell us where the consumers obtain the money to start spending more for everything. If the consumers do not have more money available in toto, then they can bid up the prices of some things only by correspondingly reducing their purchases of other things. But that implies that the prices of these other things tend to fall. No problem of inflation would exist, therefore. I will not attempt to follow the greed doctrine in all the possible twists and turns it might take at this point, because no one, to my knowledge, has actually presented any kind of clear-cut exposition of the doctrine. So I will not create arguments for myself to refute that the doctrine's own supporters have not created. I will simply observe that what the doctrine is citing as the cause of higher prices is people's desire for a higher standard of living. Now, not only is this not a cause of higher prices, but in reality, it is the cause of lower prices. Because what people must do to raise their standard of living is produce more. And this is exactly what everyone tries to do who is seriously interested in improving his standard of living. From the inventor or businessman who develops a new industry or better method of production, to an ordinary worker who upgrades his skills. We have now concluded our examination of all the theories offered as alternatives to the quantity theory of money. We have seen that each of them serves to confirm the quantity theory of money. I believe that it is fair to say that we can now regard the quantity theory as proven. And that means, of course, that we must accept the government's responsibility for inflation as an established fact. It is in this light that we must regard the government's attempts to control prices. Before turning to the subject of price control, however, I must point out that our discussion of inflation has not exhausted the subject by any means. We have covered essentially only one aspect, namely how an expanding quantity of money created by the government is responsible for rising prices. It would take a discussion at least as long as the ones we have had to go into such important matters as how inflation arbitrarily redistributes wealth and income, how it undermines saving and investment and destroys accumulated capital, how it causes depressions and precipitates deflations, why it does not reduce unemployment but creates it, and how ultimately it threatens the very existence of money, of the division of labor, and of material civilization itself. Unfortunately, limitations of time prevent my going into these matters in this course, except to a limited extent in the question period, perhaps. Ladies and gentlemen, we are now ready to begin to study the consequences of price controls. On the basis of what we have already learned, namely, that inflation is strictly a problem of the government's increase in the money supply, it is obvious that price controls are an utterly futile, ineffectual method of dealing with inflation. They simply bear no relation whatever to the essential features of the problem. They are about as appropriate a solution to the problem of inflation as would be a doctor's efforts to reduce the fever of his patient by placing his patient's thermometer in ice water. But controls are not merely ineffectual, they are positively, disastrously harmful. In order to understand why and in what ways, however, we must first develop an understanding of how a free market, a market free of price controls, operates. This will occupy us tonight and for the next two lectures. Even in the course of this discussion of the free market, however, we will be able to make a number of important direct applications to price controls, because we will be able to trace out how a free economy would behave differently in cases in which we presently have price controls, or would have behaved differently in cases in which we have recently had them. My theme in discussing the free market will be the socially harmonizing and benevolent influence of the profit motive. Tonight, we are going to see how the profit motive brings about a harmonious balancing of the relative size of the various industries. That is, how it keeps the production of all the various goods properly coordinated with one another. Closely related to this, we are going to see how the profit motive gives to consumers the power to control what is produced, and how it acts progressively to expand the overall total of production and thereby continuously to raise living standards. Finally, in the light of the knowledge we will have gained, at the close of this evening's lecture, we will examine some cases of existing price controls and observe the difference that their repeal would make. The best way to begin our discussion is with the establishment of a very simple and very important principle. And that is that there is a tendency in the free market toward the establishment of a uniform rate of profit on capital invested in all the different branches of industry. I'll repeat this. There is a tendency in the free market toward the establishment of a uniform rate of profit on capital invested in all the different branches of industry. In other words, there is a tendency for capital invested to yield the same percentage rate of profit, whether it is invested in the steel industry, the oil industry, the shoe business, or wherever. The reason for this tendency is that investors naturally prefer to earn a higher rate of profit rather than a lower rate of profit. As a result, wherever the rate of profit is higher, they tend to invest additional capital, and where it is lower, they tend to withdraw capital they have previously invested. The investment of additional capital in an initially more profitable industry, however, tends to reduce the rate of profit in that industry, because the effect of the investment of additional capital is to increase the industry's production and thus to reduce the selling prices of its products. As the selling prices of its products are pushed down closer to its costs of production, the rate of profit earned by the industry necessarily falls. Conversely, the withdrawal of capital from an initially less profitable industry tends to raise the rate of profit in that industry, because less capital means less production, higher selling prices on the reduced supply, and thus a higher rate of profit on the capital that remains. To illustrate this process, let's assume that initially the computer industry, say, is unusually profitable, while the motion picture industry is earning a very low rate of profit or incurring actual losses. In such conditions, people will obviously want to invest in the computer industry and to reduce their investments in the motion picture industry. As investment in the computer industry is stepped up, the output of computers will be expanded. In order to find buyers for the larger supply of computers, their price will have to be reduced. Thus, the price of computers will fall, and as a result, the rate of profit earned in producing them will fall. On the other hand, as capital is withdrawn from the motion picture industry, the output of that industry will fall, and the reduced supply it offers will be sold at higher prices, thereby raising the rate of profit on the investments that remain in the industry. In just this way, initially higher rates of profit are brought down, and initially lower rates of profit are raised up. The logical stopping point is a uniform rate of profit in all the various industries. Now, this principle of the tendency of the rate of profit toward uniformity is what explains the amazing order and harmony that exists in production in a free market. It was largely the operation of this principle, incidentally, that Adam Smith had in mind when he declared that a free economy works as though it were guided by an unseen hand. Observe, in the United States, production is carried on by several million independent business enterprises, each of which is concerned with nothing but its own profit. Knowing this and knowing nothing about economics, one might easily be led to think, of such conditions as a, quote, anarchy of production, which is how Karl Marx described them. One might easily be led to expect that because production was in the hands of a mass of independent, self-interested producers, the market would randomly be flooded with some items while people perished from a lack of others as a result of the discoordination of the producers. This, of course, is the image conjured up by those who advocate government, quote, planning. They believe that the free market is chaotic. The uniformity of profit principle explains how the activities of all the separate business enterprises are harmoniously coordinated so that capital is not invested excessively in the production of some items while leaving the production of other items unprovided for. The operation of the uniformity of profit principle is what keeps the production of all the different items, directly or indirectly necessary to our survival, in proper balance. It acts to counteract and prevent mistakes leading to the relative overproduction of some things and the relative underproduction of other things. Let us consider an example in order to understand this point. Let us assume that businessmen make a mistake. They invest too much capital in producing refrigerators and not enough capital in producing television sets, say. Because of the uniformity of profit principle, the mistake is necessarily self-correcting and self-limiting. Observe why. The effect of the overinvestment in refrigerator production is to depress profits in the refrigerator industry, because the excessive quantity of refrigerators that can be produced can be sold only at prices that are low in relation to costs. By the same token, the effect of the underinvestment in television set production is to raise profits in the television set industry, because the deficient quantity of television sets that can be produced can be sold at prices that are high in relation to costs. The very consequence of the mistake, therefore, is to create incentives for its correction. The low profits or losses, if the overinvestment is serious enough, of the refrigerator industry act as an incentive to the withdrawal of capital from the refrigerator industry, while the high profits of the television set industry act as an incentive to the investment of additional capital in the television set industry. Moreover, the consequence of the mistake is not only to create incentives for its correction, but simultaneously to provide the means for its correction. By that I mean, the high profits of the television set industry are not only an incentive to investment in the television set industry, but are themselves a source of investment in the television set industry, in that high profits can themselves be plowed back into the industry. By the same token, to the extent that the refrigerator industry suffers losses or earns a rate of profit that is too low to cover the dividends its owners need to live on, its capital directly and immediately shrinks, and it is thereby made unable to continue producing on the same scale. In this way, the mistakes made in the relative production of the various goods in a free market are self-correcting. With good reason, the operation of profit and loss in guiding the increase and decrease in investment and production has been compared to an automatic governor on a machine or to a thermostat on a boiler. As investment and production go too far in one direction and not far enough in another direction, the very mistake itself sets in motion counteracting forces of correction. And please observe, the greater the mistake that is made, the more powerful are the counteracting forces of correction. Because the greater the overinvestment and overproduction, the greater the losses. And the greater the underinvestment and underproduction, the greater the profits. And thus the greater the incentives and the means, or loss of means, to bring about the correction. In this way, the mistakes made in a free market are not only self-correcting, but self-limiting as well. The bigger the mistake, the harder it is to make it. Furthermore, in a free market, most of the mistakes that might be made in determining the relative size of the various industries and the relative production of the various goods are not made in the first place. This is because the prospect of profit or loss causes businessmen to weigh investment decisions very carefully in advance, and thus to avoid mistakes as far as possible from the very beginning. Please observe that in seeking to avoid losses, businessmen necessarily aim at avoiding overinvestment and overproduction. In seeking to make the highest possible profits, they necessarily aim at providing the market with those goods in whose production they do not expect other businessmen to invest enough. And this last fact, incidentally, makes each businessman eager to invest sufficiently in his own industry, lest the opportunities he does not seize be seized by others instead. In addition, the free market exercises a constant process of selection with respect to the ownership of capital. Capital gravitates, as it were, to those businessmen who know best how to employ it, and is taken away from those who do not know how to employ it. For those who invest in providing goods that are relatively more needed, make high profits, and are thereby able to expand their capitals, and consequently their influence over future production, while those who invest in producing goods that are relatively less needed earn low profits or suffer losses and are correspondingly deprived of capital and of influence over future production. At any given time, therefore, capital in a free market is mainly in the hands of those who are best qualified to use it, as demonstrated by their past performance in investing. For this reason, too, as I say, most of the mistakes that might be made in determining the relative production of the various goods are avoided in the first place in a free market. The uniformity of profit principle not only explains how a free market prevents and counteracts such mistakes, but also how the consumers in a free market have the power of positive initiative to change the course of production. All the consumers need do to cause production to shift is to change the pattern of their spending. If the consumers decide to buy more of product A and less of product B, the production of A automatically becomes more profitable and that of B less profitable. Capital then flows to A and away from B. The production of A is thus expanded and that of B contracted, until once again both A and B afford neither more nor less than the general or average rate of profit. Of course, businessmen do not sit back and passively wait for the consumers to shift their demand. On the contrary, businessmen seek to anticipate changes in consumer demand and to adjust production accordingly. And of course, they seek to constantly introduce whatever new or improved products they believe are of such nature as to attract a sufficient consumer demand once the consumers learn of the product. Businessmen will produce anything for which they believe consumers will pay profitable prices, and they will cease to produce anything for which the consumers are unwilling to pay profitable prices. In this sense, business is totally at the disposal of the consumers. The consumer is king, as the saying goes. It should not be difficult to see that the real advocates of the consumers, their virtual agents, are businessmen seeking profit, not the leaders of groups trying to restrict the freedom of businessmen to earn profits. Such groups, called ironically the consumer movement, seek to force businessmen to produce things the consumers do not want to buy, like automobile seatbelts, and to prohibit them from producing things the consumers do want to buy, like breakfast cereals that are enjoyable to eat. The uniformity of profit principle explains how the profit motive acts to make production steadily increase in a free market. It explains how the profit motive becomes an agent of progressive improvement in production. Please observe that in order to earn a rate of profit that is above average, it is necessary for businessmen to anticipate changes in consumer demand ahead of their rivals, to introduce new and/or improved products ahead of their rivals, or to cut the costs of production ahead of their rivals. I say ahead of their rivals because as soon as any innovation becomes general, then, in accordance with the uniformity of profit principle, no special profit can be made from it. For example, the first firms that produced shoes by machinery rather than by hand, or that put zippers in clothing, or that were found a way to sell a cigar for 10 cents, or whichever, were able to make above average rates of profit by doing so. But once such things become general, no special profit, or once such things became general, no special profit could any longer be made from them. They became the ordinary standard of the industry and were taken for granted. Sooner or later, virtually every innovation does become general. And this implies that for any firm to continue to earn an above average rate of profit, it must repeatedly outdistance its rivals. It must work as an agent of continuing progress and thus contribute to the progressive increase in production. Perhaps one of the most dramatic examples of this is provided by the career of Henry Ford I. When the Ford Motor Company began in the early part of this century, the automobile was a rich man's toy. Extremely primitive models by our standards were selling for about $10,000 in the very valuable money of the time. Henry Ford began to find ways to improve the quality of automobiles and at the same time cut the costs of their production. But it was not possible for Ford to make a single improvement or a single cost reduction and stop there, because it was not long before that improvement and that cost reduction were generally adopted in the industry and indeed superseded. Had Ford stood pat at the level he had achieved as of any given time, it would not have been long before his once profitable business was destroyed by the competition. In order for Ford to go on making a high rate of profit, he had to continuously introduce improvements and reduce costs ahead of his rivals. The same is true in principle in a free market of any individual or firm that earns an above average rate of profit over an extended period of time. What was good enough once to make a high rate of profit ceases to be good enough as soon as enough others are able to do the same thing. In order to go on earning an above average rate of profit, one must continue to stay ahead of the competition. By the same token, any business that stands pat is necessarily finished in a free economy, no matter how great its past successes. Because the technological advances of each earlier generation are progressively reduced to the status of primitive gropings from the standpoint of a technologically more advanced later generation. Think how absurd it would be in virtually any industry to try to make money today by producing with the most advanced, most profitable technology of 1900, 1920, or even 1950, and not bothering to adapt to the changes that have taken place since then. Now, I want to explain in a little more detail just how the competitive quest for an above average rate of profit expands the total of production in the economic system. It is probably almost self-evident that the introduction of new and/or improved products constitutes an increase in production, or is a source of an increase in production. One has only to think of such cases as the automobile replacing the horse and buggy, or the automobile with a self-starter replacing the hand-cranked automobile, or such cases as the tractor bringing about a vast increase in the production of agricultural products, or the electric motor bringing about a vast increase in the production of all kinds of manufactured goods. It may be less obvious, however, how the day-by-day attention of businessmen to costs and their constant effort to reduce the costs of production are no less a source of the increase in production. Still less obvious is the role in increasing production that is played by correct anticipations of changes in consumer demand. Therefore, let us briefly consider the contribution of these factors to increasing production.
This is the end of side B. Please go on to the next cassette, beginning with side C.